Welcome to the Dope CFO Podcast, where you can find the best information for accountants and bookkeepers that want to start and grow a highly profitable and flexible remote cannabis accounting firm. With your host, Andrew Hunziker. Now that's dope.
Hey everybody, this is Andrew Hunziker, CPA, also CFO, founder of Dope CFO as well. About my background, I've been a CPA for over 25 years, was at a big four, including PricewaterhouseCoopers. I won the gold medal award for the highest score in the CPA exam, as well as was runner up for the Portland, Oregon Business Journal CFO of Year Award in 2017. And I was the first ever cannabis CFO to be nominated. Done lots of startup work as well. And love teaching all of our community. We have now over 500 people in all 50 states in our Dope CFO program.
All right. Well, hello, everybody. Super excited for this show. I already can tell you this is going to be a hugely downloaded show. And we have amazing guests, Rachel Gillette and Jennifer Benda from Holland Hart in Denver. They are two of the leading cannabis tax attorneys in all of cannabis. And they also will be at the AICP conference with me as well. I know last year, Jen, when you were on stage, that was there. You only had an hour and it was jam packed, standing room only. And that conference, that session could have gone on for several hours. So let's dive in. I'm going to let each of you jump. Why don't we start with you, Rachel? Give us, I always like to hear your background story, like how you got into law. It doesn't need to be 10 minutes, but how you got into law and cannabis and kind of how we call it your high story, how I got here.
So I got into cannabis because I was working in tax controversy out of law school. And I worked with a group of attorneys, and many of us were proponents of the legalization of cannabis. At the time, it was 2010, and Colorado was there were a lot of people in Colorado who were being caregivers. They were setting up businesses, and the state stepped in to regulate and or pass regulations or legislation, House Bill 10-1284, in order to license medical marijuana businesses at the time. And it was new because even though California's medical marijuana law had been around a lot longer than Colorado's, Colorado was the first state to actually allow for for-profit medical marijuana businesses. And I saw that the Department of Revenue was going to be the regulating agency. I saw that there was going to be a new law that was a new industry that was developing. And I actually decided to quit my job and start my own practice representing these new medical marijuana businesses that were going to have to apply for licenses in the middle of 2010 in order to continue operating. And I was told by numerous people I was going to lose my law license because it was illegal under federal law. But I'm sort of a risk taker in my career. And I decided to push forward. And I did have a background in tax controversy, which actually translated very well into the practice, cannabis practice. So it just kept growing from there. And that's how I started. So that was back in 2010.
Well, that's awesome. You are an OG for certain then, and Colorado led the way. And Jen, let's jump into your backstory as well.
So I have a much nerdier backstory. I was a CPA before law school and spent a lot of time on a lot of different accounting issues. One of them being inventory accounting. And I moved to Colorado in 2007. And as Rachel said, a few years later, that's when the Colorado was on this path to have these businesses. And when CCA 2015-04-011 came out, I thought, well, gosh, this is interesting. Why would they deny 263 Cap A to people? They want everyone else to apply it. And I thought, well, the IRS is, you know, arguing against what it would in almost any other situation. I thought, well, that's a really interesting issue. And I just kind of followed it from there. And then one day I got a referral from an accountant who said, well, there's this potential client that might need to litigate a 263 Cap A issue. And I was like, well, gosh, who could that be? And I got a call from a GC of a Colorado company. This was in 2015. And he said, you know, we have this issue and, you know, we're a cannabis company. And I just rattled off, you know, oh yeah, the IRS is doing all these things to deny all these things to, because of 280E. And he immediately hired me once I confirmed that my firm would let me represent them. And it just kind of snowballed from there, because in that time frame, there were a lot of audits, and I've focused on IRS controversy since before I went to law school, when I was a CPA. The last job, the last two jobs I had as a CPA were manager of income tax audits for Fortune 500 company, and then in the tax controversy group for KPMG while I was in law school. So just kind of built from there, and it's been a fun ride, but a very nerdy ride. And I still focus a lot of my work in this area on that crazy inventory issue that I happened to have written a paper on when I was getting my master's in accounting. So it's all rooted back to 1995 when I wrote that paper.
Well, that is awesome. Awesome background to both of you. And at the end of the show, we're going to go over exactly what your firm Holland Hart does and how to find you and all that as well. But let's dive in then to the main content. And kind of as a backdrop, and we talk about this, I know you're on the AICPA Cannabis Committee with me, and we talk about this idea of, and people in my group of dope CFOs and CPAs and accountants are always asking me, well, what's the answer to this issue? And what's the, and it almost always is, it depends. There's facts and circumstances, and who are the owners and how many entities and who are the investors and all these different things. And so people want these answers. Well, Jen told me I can do this on 263A, so I can do it with anybody. So I like to put that backdrop in on one, it depends. And then also, if you're a tax preparer, enrolled agent or CPA, and you're doing the return, you know, you may, I know some tax preparers that are insanely aggressive. As a matter of fact, the first tax return I ever saw in cannabis, and I'm not a tax preparer, I came from the audit side, I saw, and I was like, I immediately said, this is wrong. It was a dispensary, and the sales were $4 million almost exactly, and cost of goods sold was $3,999,999. And it was like, and net income was $1. And it was like, wow. Oh, this is wrong. But that's a CEO and a tax preparer taking an insanely aggressive position. So just as a backdrop, do you have any thoughts on kind of the, as we go in and dive, hit, look at some of these codes on things do depend on your stance, kind of where you stand?
Well, I think that, you know, to your point, one of the biggest things is, you know, how does your business operate? And the way I think about inventory is like valuation. It's not a precise inventory cost. It's not a precise number. It's kind of a range. And there's a lot of judgment calls that get made. And it, when you look at GAAP, there's a lot of judgment that people can use in determining inventory under GAAP. We have a lot more specific rules in the tax rules. And why not pull what you can out of those and try to use it to support a position? And accountants can get different, you know, different comfort levels at, with different positions, but it's always a marrying of, okay, how do we find the most advantageous league law and then the facts that we have here and see how that puts, how that shakes out. I mean, one of the big divisions that everyone knows is, you know, retailers and manufacturers can be treated very differently. So, you know, as an initial starting point, which bucket are we in and how aggressive do we have to be based on the rules that the IRS acknowledges apply versus the rules we think we should argue apply?
No, that's a great point. And we'll dive into that a little bit more. What about, maybe before we dive into actual tax code and cases, just because I know the topic of rescheduling or descheduling is on everyone's mind. I spoke on it today briefly on Facebook Live and looking at some of the different articles out. And I know it's anybody's guess, but since you all are kind of on the inside, maybe you all could each jump in on this one. Where do you think we are? From what I know, we started that process in 2022. HHS did the review. August, they said, hey, we recommend Schedule 3. FDA chimed in. I know Biden's pushing for it. And I think where it is now, it's sitting on someone's desk and they can either go approved or disapproved. And that's it. But let me know, is that where we are? And so I tell people to come out tomorrow or 3 months from now, one or the other.
Yeah, well, we know that the government doesn't work quickly. So who knows? It could happen tomorrow. It could happen 3 years from now. But I hope that some kind of rescheduling will occur before the election or as soon as possible. I know the DEA is reviewing the classification of cannabis. But, you know, the one thing that I think is important is that the HHS has acknowledged that cannabis has an accepted medical use in the United States, and that it should not be a Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 controlled substance. And it doesn't have a high potential for abuse either. So there's no severe physiological or psychological dependence. And so it shouldn't be classified as Schedule 1, which is interesting because, you know, does that mean or does it follow then that 280E never should have applied? I mean, who knows? You know, I hope we haven't given up on descheduling cannabis, because I think the industry is really focused on taking whatever they can get, and relief from 280E is such a game changer for this industry that obviously rescheduling is better than descheduling. And obviously descheduling is better than rescheduling, but rescheduling is better than nothing. I hope it happens. I've been saying that cannabis is going to be descheduled for the last 14 years next year. It just hasn't happened yet. So I certainly will. It will be a good day when it does occur, especially if it's Schedule 3, then we know that 280E will no longer apply.
And Jen, I'll let you jump in as well. And just thoughts on, just for our audience who don't know, and tell me if I'm wrong, I always think of descheduling is like alcohol. I can drive over to the liquor store. It's not on any schedules. I got to be 21, still regulated. I got to be 21. And it's interesting, all those things you just listed off, like potential for abuse, no known medical use. You could easily just flip them. Let's put alcohol on Schedule 1 and take cannabis off. That would knock down drunk driving a lot. But any other thoughts you have as well, Jen?
I mean, I think it's going to happen when we least expect it. And I do think the election is going to play a factor. But to your point, I've spoken to, you know, former police officers who say, I'd rather deal with someone who's smoking marijuana than someone who's drunk. And so I think that's gauging all of our, you know, taint on why this substance has been treated so negatively for so long.
But I want to also mention, too, like how rescheduling to Schedule 3 impacts, you know, states where there's legal cannabis, because the bottom line is rescheduling to Schedule 3, there are still going to be conflicts with state laws. It's still not going to be federally legal. And, you know, it's so I think that is going to cause a lot of complications. Obviously, there's some benefits, but there's going to be complications. Potential other benefits are maybe there'll be, you know, pathways to commercial lending. Maybe SAFER will finally pass and become law. Maybe there'll be more research, product development and innovation in the industry. Maybe cannabis businesses will have access to bankruptcy courts. You know, hopefully it will really help businesses. Getting rid of 280E will help businesses and their bottom line, and for them to to prosper and be able to reinvest, et cetera. But it's going to cause a lot of complications as well. I mean, that's the bottom.
I think what Rachel's saying is that the 280E savings, there's going to be some costs that are, you know, right, eat up some of those savings.
Well, no, that's great. And I thought of a couple of things. I was like, you know, when Colorado legalized, thank you for taking that step, because Colorado is still standing. It didn't fall apart. My home state of Oklahoma sued Colorado. I remember Colorado legalized and right, not 5 years later, they were, Forbes called Oklahoma the most cannabis friendly state in the U.S. And a deeply red state. So I did see a Pew poll come out today that was 88% of Americans. And I was like, it's just crazy that approve or want medical cannabis. There is almost nothing. I said, if you did a vote of is the sky blue, we would not get 9 out of 10 Americans to agree. So that's a huge positive as well. So it's okay. So good news. Another side note, and you all may hear this too, like, oh, when 280E goes away, you two are going to be out of work. And so am I, because they're not going to need CPAs and lawyers anymore. It's like, it's like, do you know any other industry that doesn't need attorneys and CFOs and whatnot? So like you said, there's going to be a lot of complications and other issues. And why don't we jump into kind of some of the 280E stuff, since there is some news around that. And it came out so, and I'm interested to learn about this myself. So I'm kind of following along. I'm not a tax expert. I follow the court cases and like Harborside, it went on for all these years and they spent a fortune on attorneys. They said, we're going to do 263A and this, that, and the other. It's not constitutional. They spent money and lost it. And then Trulieve just comes in and says, oh, let's just file for refunds, 100 million or whatever, and get some money back. And I'm looking there, does that work? That's, and then now other MSOs are doing it. And then just to even more color, if it had been any other cannabis company other than Trulieve, which in my mind, the second I hear the word Trulieve, I'm thinking criminals and people that have been shady past, they haven't kept a CFO in quite a while. They're one of the CFOs, maybe did fraud as well. So I'm just like, anytime Trulieve does anything, my eyebrows raise. But let me get your all's thought on kind of that kind of latest in the news, and should everyone do this?
Well, there's lots of rumor and not a lot of real information, right? And so I think one thing that's generally acknowledged is that companies taking this position are relying on probably a reasonable basis legal opinion, and that's a 20% chance of success. And I think we have to take that on its face. I haven't heard anyone say that they think this is anything other than a long shot. And I think what it is there are arguments out there that haven't been made, and there are lawyers who want to make those arguments. And if that gives people an ability to file an amended return or take a position that they're not going to pay 280E for a current year, they need to weigh, you know, the cost benefit of that and think about whether they want to incur the cost of litigating this, because without a doubt, this is something that's going to have to go all the way to the Supreme Court. And that's, you know, a pretty daunting undertaking. And so, you know, posturing yourself so that you're not someone who has to lead the way, if that's not what you're willing to do, can be a little bit tricky. So we can't really say anything about what's actually going on, because nobody really knows.
And if I'm the CFO of Trulieve, I'm like, hey, let's just file this amended return, get 100 million. And I was actually surprised that if I was in the IRS's shoes, I would be like, I'm not giving you 100 million. Let's go to court first. Then I'll give you the money back. But it sounds like someone actually gave them the money back. But then you're saying this is going to go into litigation. So when Trulieve does this, they need to expect they're opening their doors. IRS is going to come in. They're going to look under the hood and it's going to be litigated. So it's really inviting them into your place, and yes, incurring lots of legal costs.
Yeah,
I can't imagine they're just going to write a check for 100 million and walk away.
Yeah, we've heard lots of theories about why they might have received the 100 million. I don't I don't think it's worth airtime to really entertain all those or list them. Because, you know, then we're just part of the rumor mill. But I think that you're right. It's highly unlikely that nothing's going to happen after this to Trulieve, and they're just going to get to keep all the money. I think that's highly unlikely.
Yeah. And they've stated numerous times that their claims were specific to their business and their operations. There is no one size fits all kind of approach here. So given the fact that we don't really know, I mean, I do think you have to consider all of the risks versus rewards in potentially filing a refund claim. And I think public companies are very different, and they're in a different position than a small, you know, smaller company in considering whether to pursue an amended and a refund, amended return and a refund. Because the costs, I mean, the costs of litigating, the costs of being audited, I mean, those are all things that should go into the consideration of whether to pursue this strategy. And then you also have to look at your own facts and circumstances, your own business, your own operations, and you have to get the right opinions, et cetera, from professionals. So it, you know, it just depends on, you have to look at the picture. And I think a lot of people just want to hear something good, and so they're willing to follow. But as my mom said, you know, if your friend jumped off a bridge, would you follow? Like, you know.
Well, and we've seen an example of this being really bad before, and not in the marijuana world. It's in like the listed transaction world, where, you know, people were marketing listed certain types of transactions to public companies. And I know that one of the lines was, everybody else is doing this, and if you don't, your earnings per share are going to suffer. And so people felt trapped into doing these things. And that was the listed transaction world. Was it took a long time to unwind all that. There's still cases every now and then that you see. So it's not a new thing to see something like this happening. I think, you know, it's, everyone has to think about it based on whether there's any real benefit to them. And if you're going to save $100,000, but getting audited and litigating this is going to cost you more than $100,000, maybe you just want to pay that 280E and move on with your life and have your 2020 tax return closing in October rather than dealing with it for the next 10 years. I mean, I still have cases for 2012. And that means the IRS, if we assess soon, they have 10 more years to collect that tax. So that's another conversation we have with people about, you know, paying their taxes and how long do you want this to drag out?
Is there, which brings up another question, is there a difference between Trulieve, I'm filing an amended return and I want my money back, and, oh, I'm just going to do a protective refund on 2021 and 22 just in case I think 280E is unconstitutional, in case maybe a couple of years down the line the courts agree with me or whatever. Is that worth doing? Or is that, like you say, you're kind of opening your doors up to being audited?
Well, the protective claim is just kind of a placeholder.
Yeah.
It's not, you're not asking the IRS to give you any money. You're saying, hey, it looks like something may change, but my statute of limitations is about to expire. And hey, I want to keep it open in case this changes. That's what you're doing with a protective claim. And you have to articulate a pretty specific contingency. And I think that's the most important part of making sure you file a protective claim that isn't just immediately rejected, that actually does what you want to do, which is gives you the opportunity, if someone wins in one of these cases, to go back and say, here's the tax. And you should put on that form how much you would get due, you know, how much of money you're asking for back if 280E didn't apply. And that's pretty simple math for most people, I think. So you want to put that number on there, and you want to have a good basis. And there's guidance we can look at to make sure that we check the boxes and make sure that protective claim does what you want it to do.
Yeah, I'd say it's not as simple as just filing an amended return and writing protective claim for a refund on the form. That's, you really do have to explain what the what the grounds are for that protective claim. What are the contingencies? What are the facts that and circumstances and you have to sign it under penalty of perjury. So you want to make sure you file a protective claim that meets the requirements to be a valid claim, like Jen said. Otherwise, they could potentially reject it. So.
One thing, I'm going to just get a pitch for you all. So I've seen this in cannabis a lot. Business owners want to just do their own legal. They use Google for their legal, or they follow other people. Same in accounting. I don't need an expert CFO. I can do it myself or whatever. And I'm like, look, if you really think you've got a decent claim and you want to file for $100,000, whatever it is, protective refund, you should go call Rachel and Jen. They're expensive, but they're worth it. Pay them. And you can, I mean, I'm guessing you can look at their situation and say, I think you've got a legitimate claim. We can file it, da, da, da. And instead of just saying, oh, I read in the newspaper, Trulieve did this, and so I'm going to do it, which I think many people.
Yeah, that's not going to be valid. I mean,
yeah.
And the real trick here is, is there an actual case? You need to identify a change in the law, a change in the regulations, or case law that might change the outcome. And what's the case you're going to identify that's definitely going to change your situation? That's the important analysis. And that's where I think it is a case-by-case analysis.
And by the way, say tomorrow we go to Schedule 3, nobody knows for certain. Does that mean I can go back 10 years? Or does it go start tomorrow? Or does it start January 1? Where does 280 actually go away? Is that going to be possibly more? Well, then that's a good question. Let's just say tomorrow they approve it. Does that mean as of tomorrow, 280E doesn't apply no matter what, or is there going to be further maybe litigation around when this?
There could be further litigation, but I would say that the day they reschedule, that's the day that 280E no longer applies. But I want to go back.
I think IRS view of it as well. Not that's correct. I mean, I think that's going to be their view until someone pushes on them. And then it just raises a whole host of issues of how do you file your 2024 returns? I think there's a lot of things that it would be really helpful to get the IRS to engage on. Let's just come up with a strategy of how to deal with these issues that we have to figure out, because this is happening as of some random day in the middle of the year.
And we haven't even, and we won't dive into all the, I actually had a call last weekend from a friend in Texas asking me about Delta 8 and CBD and the farm bill and all that stuff. There's just lots of uncertainties. That's going to continue. Why don't we kind of wrap up with, tell us about Holland Heart, how you all specifically can help cannabis companies, who you can help, what type of people should be looking to engage with you. And then you can tell us the easy way to connect with you or we'll put it all in the show notes too.
Sure. So I serve the cannabis industry, people in the cannabis industry. So businesses that are plant touching, hemp businesses, ancillary companies, investors, landlords, whoever. If it's something surrounding cannabis, those are the types of clients I represent. I do a lot of work in tax controversy, but I also focus on corporate and regulatory as well.
And by that you mean like setting up an entity or raising capital?
Yeah,
or
M&A, anything like that. Yes. Yeah, so we can do it all. We're actually a full service law firm, so we can do it all. We have a great IP practice. We have a great tax group. We have a great corporate group, employment group. So we can really serve businesses and all of their needs, legally speaking. So,
and I'm focused on tax. I have not, I don't exclusively work with cannabis companies. I'm kind of a full service tax controversy person. And I think that involves a few things that we deal with for the industry, these exams, protests, litigation, tax litigation. We deal with collections. Yeah, I was just going there next. You know, right now we're dealing with some really interesting issues on M&A transactions. And so yesterday I was on the call, a call with a buyer, a buyer of a client who's trying to sell some stores and talking about the tax liabilities and whether they have any exposure, you know, what the exposures are for liens and things like that. So there's a whole host of issues that occur when your tax returns are being challenged or when you have deficiencies. And that is where I focus.
Now that's awesome to hear. And I love hearing someone's buying. Okay, the market's turning back up.
It's a buyer's market right now.
Yeah, it is a buyer's market.
Because there's a lot of distressed businesses out there. So yeah.
Definitely.
Hopefully that will change.
And I really recommend getting that full service firm. I just believe if you're going to invest millions of dollars in a manufacturing or farm or dispensary chain, you need experts on your side. And sometimes they don't think about that. Like you said, it could be collections, it could be HR, it could be employment. What about partner disputes? Our buddy Ron Senior loves to bring up that, I mean, because lots of these cannabis companies, we see them all the time. Oh, we've got a side deal under the table and we're partners or this, that, and the other. It's like, well, did you know most partnerships end up in court for certain? So get that stuff hammered out. So that has been really, really great to have you all. This explains a lot better to me as well. And I think still it comes back to, if you're thinking about doing any of these strategies, get off Google, call Rachel, and get some real advice for your company, not for someone else's company. And that's the way to handle it. So thank you all so much for being on. We're going to see you all in Denver as well soon. And really excited to see what happens this year.
Yeah. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Dope CFO Cannabis Accounting Podcast. Every other Monday, we air tips and insights on cannabis and CBD hemp accounting. Make sure you subscribe today and also check us out on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, YouTube. We're pretty much everywhere for more advice, tips, industry news as well. To find out more about our cannabis and CBD accounting program, visit dopecfo.com and don't forget to be dope.